And executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we use art to teach science. And welcome to...
She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
And today we are going to be talking about how science inspires art and how technology can and is providing many new opportunities in the arts. And of course, as usual, we welcome your questions. You can do so by giving us a call at 317-788-3314. And Mark, our guests are back in studio with us once again. Introduce them to everybody.
Yay. Our guests today are both part of the University of Indianapolis's Art and Design Department. Jim Vway, who's chairman of the department. Jim has both a BFA and an MFA in drawing and an MFA in painting.
Yes.
Welcome, Jim.
Thank you.
Good to have you here again.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Great to be here again.
And Jim, in addition to being an educator, you're also a professional artist. You do exhibits regionally and nationally, and you have work in private and corporate and museum locations.
Yes, I do.
That's very cool.
Yes.
And you curate a permanent collection on campus that's heavily involved in establishing changing exhibits in the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Gallery.
Right. We do six exhibitions each year in the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Gallery. Currently, we're sort of in between exhibitions. So between number five and number six, we do a senior thesis exhibition with our graphic design students, which closed yesterday, so that's done. And so right now we're getting ready to transition to our annual student exhibition. So each year we have our art majors, and they'll enter about 350 pieces or so into the student exhibition. We hire outside jurors, one in fine arts and one in design, and they'll come in and jury the exhibition down to about 100 pieces, and then we'll have an exhibition of those works.
Wow.
Ooh,
yes.
It's exciting.
It is very exciting. The students are scurrying all over the department right now trying to get those works ready to go.
And also with us, we have Randy Fry, who's assistant professor of art and design. And Randy, I know you specialize in illustration, animation, and digital media, and we got only a brief conversation with you on an earlier show, and that we brought you back so we could have a much longer one.
Yeah,
welcome.
This is great. Thank you.
So it's probably your students that are scurrying around that Jim was referring to, I'm
yes,
guessing.
Yes, they are, yes.
What, how do you encourage them to enter shows like this and make sure that they get their work seen?
Well, I mean, it's an important part of being an artist. It's a great experience for them, you know, as an introduction to this is being a professional artist and getting your work out there. And, you know, we work on projects all year. And anytime we work on a project, I say, okay, we got this student exhibition coming up at the end of the year. This would be a great project that you could enter, you know, if you're happy with it. Let's work on revisions, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Is it is it juried by different people every year, Jim?
Yes. Each year we hire different jurors, and so they're outside the university. Sometimes they're former alums. Sometimes they're just professionals in the area we know, professional artists or professional graphic designers. And so what we're, as Randy mentioned, we're just trying to teach our students. This is the life we live and die by. Shouldn't say die, I guess. but this is the way we live as artists, that we are trying to produce works, that we're putting them out there, and they have to be jurored. They have to be peer-reviewed to see, you know, if that's meeting the standards of, you know, what the art world is looking for. And so they're simply fulfilling the same destiny that all their faculty members are living each day, essentially, because we're all working professional artists. And so we're all constantly entering juried exhibitions ourselves, having our works peer reviewed and having them either displayed or not in galleries and museums.
I think that's interesting because a lot of times we talk about the crossover between art and science, and you said it in a good way. You used for artists a lot of times juried, but you also just used the idea of peer review, which is something that scientists go through with their work in exactly the same way.
Yes.
Can you tell us more a little bit about, I think people get confused, what does it mean to be juried? You have some of your peers. You want to describe a little bit more what that process is?
Yes. So basically, it's like being judged. And so the work is set out in a display-like fashion so that a juror, who is the judge basically, can come through and look at the work. And then they, using their expertise as a professional artist, because, again, everyone we use has been Again, kind of peer-reviewed, verified that they're a professional too, so they know what they're talking about. So it's not like, you know, we're hiring some person off the street who has no experience in art and no professionalism themselves to come in and look through their art, and they're judging it for the aesthetics, how well it works compositionally, how well it's crafted, all these sorts of things. And then it's their determination of what pieces are in the exhibition. Now, what we tell the students too all the time is that just because your piece didn't get in this time doesn't mean it's necessarily not a successful piece. Mm-hmm. But like all of us, you know, you can enter a piece in one juried exhibition, not get it in, and the next juried exhibition win the whole competition, and which has happened to us before, each
That's
one of
true.
Us.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. And Randy, I wonder if sometimes people get a work that's actually purchased that was not what the jury didn't like. Doesn't that happen sometimes too?
I mean,
an artist can go on just because you get it juried and they like it. It's like having critics look at something, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, there's kind of personal aesthetics involved whenever you're looking at artwork. But, you know, it's not something we just throw our students into either. You know, each project that we work on, we're guiding them through and kind of walking them through the critique process and talking about successes and failures and how to kind of pick yourself up and move forward and mm-hmm. how to make your pieces even better in the end, which, again, is kind of a scientist-based thing either. You know, you're working on these ideas, these experiments, and you don't know if they're always going to be the successful thing that you dreamed of or a complete failure, and that's kind of the excitement, of making art is the trial and error.
It is the trial and error. And sometimes you learn more from your failures than you do from your successes.
Right.
And it's, you know, as Randy said, we help them understand how to make the works better, too. So it's not like we're just throwing them out there. We're constantly critiquing them, helping them understand their work better, improve their work. If they don't get a work into an exhibition, then we can come back and say, okay, these are the reasons maybe why. Sometimes it's, you know, it can be, you know, maybe you, I hate to say this, but should have just paid more attention and listened to us more too, because sometimes it comes down to that too.
Yeah.
And that's what we're there as faculty for, is to help the students grow. Right. And sometimes it's just a matter of also listening and improving yourself as well.
And Randy, digital media is your expertise. Mm-hmm. So to me, that would almost seem like there might be more ways that you have to do things correctly when you're creating digital art as opposed to 2D art. Yes, no, or is it just a whole different it is a whole different genre, but
yeah, well, I think we're all familiar with animations and mm-hmm. The idea of seeing movement, and we can tell when something doesn't
work
move
right,
correctly,
yeah.
Or it's not, you're not, you know, it's maybe it's going too slow and you can see each frame, or it's going too fast and you don't know what you just saw. So yeah, maybe there's like a beginning kind of instinct that you have for this isn't working. Mm-hmm. Or maybe the storyline doesn't kind of read correctly. But I think that's, again, something about being a designer is you're communicating with your audience just mm-hmm. like a traditional studio artist too. And you want to get your ideas and your stories and your messages kind of across. You want it to read the way that you envision. And sometimes that works out, and sometimes the reader gets something else out of it. You know, sometimes that's not what you had envisioned, but you're able to share that with the viewer in a different way, and they're experiencing something new from it that you hadn't imagined. So the idea is hopefully that you your message comes across, or your image is at least aesthetically pleasing.
So I love that, because that correlates with a lot of the other arts. So when we think of movement and dance, mm-hmm. what you're doing with animation is you want it to be somewhat believable, meaning
right.
you don't want them to either be earthbound or floating unreasonably,
right? Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
people detect those, unless that's your artistic intent.
Mm-hmm.
But you're usually intending to depart from what would make something like look like it had gravity and looks like it deforms when it touches.
Right.
Those are all things. And you do that in 2D as well, but
right.
you're capturing a moment in time rather than,
right.
than a series of those.
Right.
But I think that's very interesting, because that parallels with all the others in that, mm-hmm. that there is something that becomes aesthetically pleasing.
Right. You want the viewer to kind of empathize or sympathize or have some kind of feeling towards or relationship with what you're doing. So, yeah.
Wow.
Now, is digital media and illustration still a relatively new program here at UND? Or
at UND it is, yes. Mm-hmm. It's just something we added 3 years ago. Oh.
In 2017.
Is that 2 years ago?
Oh,
okay.
Gosh.
Okay.
Yeah. Just feels like three, huh?
Well, the process.
You've done a lot, yeah.
Being here for 19 years, it all seems like it was yesterday. So I can never remember from day to day what wasn't almost 20 years ago and what was yesterday. So it all goes together. But yeah, so we just added it a couple years ago, I guess it was a couple years ago, and hired Randy to do that for us. And she has her MFA in illustration and has her great background in animation and really does a great job with the students teaching them. Because she has a particularly hard job where not only does she have to get the, as we were talking about, the kind of the aesthetics of it, mm-hmm. to look really cool, but then she's got to get all of the technical part
of it.
Yeah,
the mechanics of it.
Which I just, to me, it's just mind-boggling, mm-hmm. because you can't really screw up an oil painting too badly. So, you know, okay, yeah. you didn't stretch it right, or you didn't put the paint on exactly right. But with hers, if you don't do every little nuance of the programming right, then it doesn't work. And so that's just really.
You know, for me, mathematics is highly involved in art. In general, mm-hmm. just even how you create a perspective.
Right. Or just in how you lay out a composition.
But it's even more complicated. I know I've done a lot of teaching of animation to younger children. Mm-hmm. And you're working with mathematical equations all the time. You're changing little pieces of things to tweak some sort of movement mm-hmm. curve.
Yes.
And so you're working with mathematical curves and these equations. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a whole other level beyond doing the art, which is understanding those numbers.
It is. I mean, I think that I love that part of it. It's a different part of my brain, for sure. I think that, we've just had the program going for 2 years, and this just last ending today, I think, was mm-hmm. the first student who we've had graduating with this as his kind of concentration mm-hmm. or interest. So he's had a student exhibition, I'm really proud of him being able to combine these two kind of loves, because he's mm-hmm. I think particularly interested in that kind of technology, and it does take, you have to keep up with it. Luckily, the technology has become more and more user-friendly. Some students are more inclined to kind of that mathematical base kind of animation. But with Adobe products and some of the other software that's out there, it's becoming a little bit easier to do those mathematics without actually having to really, get into the numbers. It's a little bit more instinctive. Maybe a little bit more user-friendly for and kind of an artist's viewpoint, how to put that stuff together.
What attracted you to that form of art?
Oh, I really love tech. I had an undergrad concentration in photography and design. I really love technology. I now kind of look at still images and can kind of see them moving. I see the possibilities, like, oh, this would be great if this could move. And I also really just love stories and storytelling. And so it's a great way to combine those kind of different interests for me, the technology, the storytelling, movement, the image building, character building, world building, mm-hmm. those kind of things.
Yeah, Jim, I know that you have a lot of students before they get to Randy.
Yes.
And one of those is preparing them. So what kinds of things do you do to be able to prepare them to be a good animator?
I'm just trying to make them be able to draw, first of all.
Okay.
Yeah, which is the main thing.
Yeah.
And so I teach the drawing foundations painting area. And so what I'm trying to do is get them to understand how to create form, how to basically, I tell my beginning drawing students when they come into a class is the only thing I want you to learn in this class, which isn't really true, but it's the most important, is just to learn to see. Because just to see how the world goes together, how form goes together, it's not something they ever think about. And so when they sit down to draw something, they draw what they think they see and not what they're looking at mm-hmm. seeing. One of the first things I do the second day of class is we sit on the steps of the mall here at UIndy, and we draw the building. And because the building is very organized, is very gridded out, And we're trying to get them to understand that everything has a pattern to it. And so we're trying to get them to see the pattern, because most of my classes, you know, my students are going to go all over the place. They're going to go to Randy. They're going to go to ceramics. They're going to go to photography. They're going to go to graphic design. And so we want to start to have them understand how to see things. And so it's amazing how they don't see how the building goes together. And once you step back and look at it and they really start to see how the building is and how their drawing is, they're not doing that. So really for me, it's just about trying to get people to understand how to see form, how it all goes together, how to use line, so that when they get to Randy, she's not dealing with that as much as she's trying to start to help them understand how to you put all that together into a cool illustration, animation, so and that sort of thing.
The parallels between that and what we ask of scientists,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those are exactly the mm-hmm. same words.
Yeah. Right,
You know, yeah. is seeing.
Right.
And not bringing your own bias
right.
into
right.
what you see, being open to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it is amazing how much we have to disconnect what they think they know about the world versus what they see in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
that's just so fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they get to you, Randy, you pick it up and take it from there.
Yeah. I really emphasize, go take another drawing class with Jim. Because, I mean, it's really all about the drawing, whether it's just an illustration or actually movement mm-hmm. of the body. And we were just talking about this last week, like how much you can communicate with just a simple body posture mm-hmm. and being able to say, okay, you know, is this a person who looks like they've got a lot of confidence? You know, are they a superhero pose? Or is it somebody who's, you know, a little bit more timid and shy? And how would that posture change? Mm-hmm. And all that comes back to, do you know those foundations? Can you see that? Can you feel that in your body as you look at it and you imagine this? Can you imagine your body doing this? How would this pose feel? And then can you get that across in the drawing? Do you have those foundational
mm-hmm. right.
characteristics that you need to put it on to paper?
Yeah. And Randy does a really great job about trying to help to understand the students understand that it has to be more than just having this figure stand there with their mouth moving, that they have to start having movement within their form and think about how they're looking and interacting with the viewer, because that's you're getting this dialogue between the two, even though it's essentially a one-way dialogue where her figures are speaking to the viewer. She still has to help her students understand that. She does a great job with that. Just with Alex's exhibition that she was just talking about, that just closed. You know, he had a couple different animations within his exhibition, and the figure was moving back and forth and tilting its head while it was talking to you. And then Randy also talked to him about how to do the voiceover for the characters. Mm-hmm. And so when I was watching the character and I was watching the video, it just all of a sudden hit me. This is Alex's voice, but he's changed it enough that I couldn't understand or I didn't quite get that at first. And his inflections in his voice and trying to get the character and the way he changed his voice as the character moved and tilted his head and that sort of thing was really amazing.
Yeah, if you want to be more like a Da Vinci, then, Randy, the area that you're in with that is pretty crazy close to that. In other words, what you have is you've got math. Mm-hmm. You've got to know the science of some gravity and mm-hmm. things like that because you want to mimic what you're seeing in the mm-hmm. real world. Mm-hmm. You have to know the skills of illustration, of painting, mm-hmm. of being able to do that. And then you have to, on top of that, see what's not just still but what's in motion, which is sometimes even harder to see.
Right.
You know, the stages of motion of something are really, really tricky.
Yeah, it's really, I guess that's what I love so much about it. There's so many different aspects. You can come to it from an acting point of view, like,
yeah.
Well, how, you know, is this true? Is it believable? Are you performing in a way that is believable? You know, are you getting across your kind of points of view of the character? You know, you're also a director, like how whatever you're framing, that's what the viewer is going to see. And so what do you want to show them? What's the point of view? You know, where are you, where do you want the viewer to be looking? Where are you kind of getting close-up shots? Are you
right? And you're using multiple camera angles,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah.
To capture that. So that's the art of the whole thing of movie direction.
Right,
but exactly. You're doing it with, you know, characters that are animated but mm-hmm. and not live, but still.
Mm-hmm. That you drew.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, and oh, by the way.
My goodness. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that you had to voice Right? And we've all had bad voicing where the voice doesn't match something.
Yeah,
and
right.
You have to be really careful about that, too, that the character, the way they move and the way they seem, that they seem believable because you chose the right voice.
Right.
Wow.
Right. Getting the mouth to move in the right positions for, say, an animated character. Does that mouth movement look like it would sound like that particular vowel or consonant? Is it matching up in that way? You have to really think about these mouth movements and how, even if it's an anthropomorphic character or a real person, either way, it has to look like they're speaking in a real way, a real believable kind of manner.
Do you have students that work together on projects then that say one of them has a little bit more strength in one area than the other?
Yeah, we do. We're doing more of that as we get into advanced animation. Some of them, just in a traditional animation studio, some do just certain cells of the animation. Mm-hmm. Some are the character developers. Some work on scene building and do kind of the background information. So it's a little bit trickier. In the grading process, we have to kind of build these kind of structures for what each student is going to accomplish for this particular project. But we are doing more and more of that in the advanced classes because it is important to be able to work together. And you can also have the opportunity to build kind of bigger epics, so that's exciting, yeah. And it's great for them to be able to work together because that's going to be how it's going to be when they get into a real animation studio, hopefully.
In the real world. That's Randy Fry. She and Jim Vway are our guests this afternoon. We're talking about how science inspires art. You're invited to call in with your question. That number is 317-788-3314. We're going to take a short break, and then we will be back with more of She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
Hello, I'm Michael Toulouse of Classical Music Indy. As a host on 88.7 WICR, it's my pleasure to share a little information with you. The details, like Mozart's money troubles, Beethoven's ambition, Vivaldi's showmanship, that make the music come alive. But the greater pleasure by far is sharing the music itself. Share it with me here on a different kind of public radio.
Listen tomorrow morning from 6 to 10 on 88.7 WICR.
Monday evenings here on WICR, you can tune into the Owl Music Group radio show hosted by local jazz musician Kenny Phelps. Kenny presents interviews with local and national artists as they travel through the Indianapolis area. He features their music and spotlights agencies that produce change in and around our communities. That's the Owl Music Group radio show on Mondays at 9 p.m. on WICR The Diamond.
Dave Bagdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town. This is Rockin' Dave, inviting you to join me every Sunday at midnight for Rockin' Dave's Roots Roundup, an hour of the best rockabilly, jump blues, and western swing. That's Rockin' Dave's Roots Roundup, every Sunday at midnight on WICR The Diamond. Get your roots on!
And welcome back. I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, and you're listening to
She Says Art.
And He Says Science. And we're talking with artist and educators Jim Vway and Randy Fry.
And we're talking a lot about the correlation between science and art in more ways than one, and specifically that sometimes when you think you want to get into art, you think you don't need to know anything about science or math or anything.
No.
That's really not true.
No, that's not true at all. So it's even amazing sometimes with our students nowadays that they're so technology based that they forget there's rulers and tape measures and what's an eighth inch and what's a quarter inch, and so we're almost having to go back and teach them those things because they're just so used to not having to deal with those aspects. And so there's a lot that goes into that. And you know, how do you put a composition together? How do you think about angles and correlations between form and line and all these different things? That there's a lot that they have to think about that they just don't know yet.
19 years, you mentioned, Jim, that you've been here.
Yes.
How has the progression of the courses, the teaching of the courses, how have you seen them changed for more of that kind of interrelatedness with the students and expansion?
I think just right off the bat, the biggest thing, especially about the Department of Art and Design at UIndy, is its growth.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we moved into the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Building 25 years ago, we had 3 faculty and 40 majors. When we start in the fall, we'll have 9 faculty, we'll have associate adjuncts, we have a number of adjuncts, and almost 130 majors.
Wow.
So it's a much different place than mm-hmm. it was then. And so now we have a studio art program that incorporates animation illustration with Randy, ceramics, drawing, painting, sculpture, printmaking, and photography. So we have all the major studio areas. And so it's a much different place than it was when I started there 19 years ago. And so we very much have a faculty who is working in concert with one another from the foundations core all the way through up to help the students understand everything they need to at the foundations level so that they can move into each of the discipline areas, whether it be the studio art, if it's visual communication design, which is graphic design. And we also, one of our big majors is pre-art therapy.
Yeah, and I think that one of the important things that you both have said is how important those foundations are. That you know how to draw, or you know how to mix color, or
you know how to use your hands.
Right. Mm-hmm. And from the science viewpoint, that you understand a little bit about color theory and how it, under different illumination of colors of light, your painting will look different or your thing will look different if you use a red light to illuminate the room, for instance.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And people don't get some of those ideas, and they don't get the difference between the color theory of light itself mixing or pigment mixing.
Right.
And they're very different.
Right. Mm-hmm. Light mixing is an additive approach and color mixing is a subtractive approach. And so as you add light together, you get closer to white. And as you mix color, you move away from that, or a color as far as pigment goes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, and those are always in play. And they come, Randy, I know in your work, they both come in play because you're working not with pigments, but you're simulating pigments with light, which is, I think, a really interesting thing.
Right, yeah. We're talking about all kinds of, how the screens will look. Sometimes students have to kind of let go of their, sometimes you want that color to look a certain way. And then, in illustration, a lot of the times you don't have control over the printed process. So it's going to be printed by an outside printer. It's going to be printed in CMYK, maybe where you're printing at home. And you're working with CMYK, but oftentimes working with a color gamut that's in RGB. So it is a very kind of scientifically based idea.
Yeah, these are all languages that are kind of...
Yeah, it gets complicated.
A different world here.
Yeah, but students have to understand both. This is how it's going to look like on a screen, and this is going to be how light affects it, how you're illuminating, and then, this is how it's going to look printed.
And they can be, I've done some of my own artwork that way, and it can be totally different,
and I can
get really disappointed, or I can actually be really excited that it looks better sometimes in the print.
And sometimes you just have to let go.
That kind of leads me back to, there's always been this kind of strange rub in the outside of schools when we go to the art exhibition kinds of things that are public and they're juried. And they don't really have a category for digital art, which always kind of irritates me because they somehow think that that people are copying, or they don't know how to judge it. So you guys have developed that, but that's still true, Jim. I mean, when I look at like something that goes into Penrod, they don't have a juried thing for people that are purely digital artists.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, as technology develops, artists are, this has been the case since the photography, the camera obscura in Vermeer, they think that he used the camera obscura to understand perspective and lighting. And so since the 1600s, and so it will always change. I think eventually society catches up and we find new ways to incorporate digital art into our lives. there's this really great new using augmented reality. I found this really great app. It's called Artivive. And you can have a still image and then use your phone to it kind of reads the image almost like a UPC code, and it will then show you the movement of the art so that you can have a still image, but then hold up. Everybody has their cell phones nowadays and apps, and you just hold the app up to the image and you can see movement within it, which is really great. You know, everybody's got this now. It allows access mm-hmm. to more
viewers. Wow, that makes this incredible merger between the mm-hmm. digital, yeah. right,
right. Mm-hmm.
and the still. Mm-hmm. You, in the last exhibition, we talked about it on one of the earlier shows, but you were embedding an actual video, I mean, a television inside of a painting.
Right, yeah. And again, this is kind of a thing that I wasn't sure how it would right. turn out and was an experiment. Mm-hmm. But
turned out great.
Yeah. Thank you. I feel like there's more. I feel like I could push this in some more directions, mm-hmm. you know, develop it a little bit more. But yeah, it was very mm-hmm. exciting to yeah. be able to incorporate both together. And that's what excites me about that augmented reality idea, where you're able to put both of them together. And I think that's an exciting thing.
And as soon as it was done in the faculty exhibition, I grabbed and ran with it. So, because we yeah. installed it into the library, because I thought this is a really cool piece, because, you know, this could be something that's installed in people's houses where you have essentially this artwork and you always have your TV hanging in your house. It's just kind of on the wall.
That's right.
Where with her piece, the TV, the monitor is embedded into the piece. And so when the TV wouldn't be working, it could actually play the animation and show how it's all integrated into right. the painting or the illustration she did around the TV. And then you could actually kind of watch it if you wanted to. But it's a really cool piece because the TV is embedded in the piece and it becomes an active part of it.
Yeah, I just, when I saw that, the first thing that popped in my head was the people that have, a TV over their mantle.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I was thinking, a lot of the time, it's the TV.
Right.
But if it was embedded into a piece of art,
right.
when it wasn't the TV, then it would be a moving work of art with a still piece mm-hmm. of art, and it would be gorgeous in a house.
Yeah.
And it's incredible, kind of even ephemeral, but it background to their entire building and house.
Right.
Yeah, I think there's just so many possibilities, even in restaurants or libraries or museums mm-hmm. or something where you can
I
have
agree.
That. It allows the screen to, I think, like you were saying, both act as a TV, but when you have it off, it's just this kind of black nothingness.
Right.
right. Where if you could have this kind of moving image, it becomes almost a window into another dimension, mm-hmm. I guess.
Right.
So, I think there's a lot of... Really, this wouldn't be possible years ago. I mean, we had
no.
Zenith TVs in a huge box. Mm-hmm. You know,
right. like,
it's only, in the last several years with how the weight of the TV
and the size and the thinness. Yeah,
yeah exactly.
Right.
That's allowed, I think,
yeah.
these possibilities will.
Right.
Yeah, you're really right. I mean, yeah. and that goes to the science and technology of miniaturization
mm-hmm.
And right. making things smaller. But I remember getting what I would have thought was a giant TV a year ago. Mm-hmm. And bringing it home, and I could carry it out by myself to
right.
the car.
Yes.
It was like almost a 48-inch TV.
Yeah.
And it weighed nothing.
Right.
Yeah, that's
right.
Incredible.
It's so amazing mm-hmm. how that can be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you interview your viewers interested in seeing the piece, it's installed in the Cranert Library right now. So, across campus, we have the permanent art collection, and it's kind of been integrated as part of that. And so it's now displayed in the Cranert Library. So if you're interested, you can come on down to campus and see the piece, which is really beautiful.
Beautiful. And after you guys were on with us, excuse me, last time I went over and took a picture. So it's on I think it's on the Da Vinci Pursuit website, too, and our Instagram as well, too.
I put this one up, too.
Also in the library are a couple of your paintings as well, too.
Yeah, I have one up there, yes.
And I'm thinking of that. And this is the one with the lion in it, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When you look at that now, do you think of how it could be animated or digitalized?
I think how somebody else could do it. Yes, not me. No. I tease my students that they know more about computers on their first day of class than I have in all my years have been there. And when I look at the computer labs, I don't even know how to turn the computers on. So, but I think somebody else could do that, and that would be really cool. So, Randy could do that. I have no interest in learning how to do that, because, and that's why we have Randy.
Right.
She's a professional at it, and she's really great at it.
Well, and how do you do that with students then that come in thinking that they really do want to do the animation and the illustration and all mm-hmm. that? But as we're talking about, there's a lot more to it than just, you know, drawing it or knowing the technology of it. How do you work with a student to kind of steer them in the right direction so they're still being able to create art, do art, but maybe in a way that's going to be best for them in the long run?
Well, I mean, I think that's what's great about, you know, a program in which they get introduced to all of the arts. You mm-hmm. know, they're getting printmaking and, like we said, and they're getting a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, they get an introduction to photography, to drawing, to painting, to sculpture now, to ceramics, to animation illustration. So, you know, you have an idea maybe of what you want to do at 18.
Yeah.
And so,
you think you do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's part of the great thing about our job is we get to introduce them to all of these fantastic outlets. And then, mm-hmm. you know, they maybe had an inclination towards one way and they decide to do something else. And, you know, and we're happy for them to find the thing that they love because mm-hmm. it does take so much time. You're mm-hmm. investing so much time to become an expert in this field, you know, as much as possible. So,
and part of our foundation's core is a intro to digital creative practices course. And so that's every student that comes in has to take that course. And so they're automatically sort of getting a feel for whether they like the technology aspect of it or not. And then one of the things that we really pride ourselves on in our department is one, we're, you know, all the students have us as their faculty advisors. So the faculty advise them. Mm-hmm. We all talk to them. They take a freshman seminar class right in their first semester. Each of us come in and we present to each of the that class what each of us does as faculty and what we teach.
That's fantastic.
So they know who we are and what we do. And then we're constantly available to them to talk about, oh, you think you're interested in this? This is what we're going to do. So we're a very tight department in the sense that we're all communicating with each other and giving students the possibility to explore different options.
Yeah, and I was just thinking in my head how important those foundations are in terms of if I was working in, Randy, in your class, if I was a student, to have had some pottery making mm-hmm. before I have to draw one.
Right.
Because it's in 2D, I can draw it. But in 3D, I have to think about its shape. Wouldn't it have been nice mm-hmm. if I felt it on mm-hmm. felt clay mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. felt that? Because mm-hmm. you're forming three-dimensional objects.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that whole foundation back and forth, and mm-hmm. I think having the digital approach to it might help in the pottery. I mean, so I think that relationship is incredible.
Mm-hmm. And we really encourage our students to collaborate. So we just had a student who was interested in printmaking. And she would make these print-made kind of puppets, and then she would piece them together, and we created a stop-motion animation out of the things she did in printmaking. I know we have a student working on carving and impressing images into the ceramics on the outside of the mm-hmm. vessels. And so, you know, sometimes they have a love for one thing, and we're able to show them how they can use that in the other
right. And since our mm-hmm. you know, since we're I guess one of the advantages of being a smaller faculty is that we're all easily interchangeable and work with each other. So if one student wants to go from ceramics into you know, animation and use that as a structure for that, mm-hmm. that's easily done. Or if they're in printmaking and want to use that as a process within some other medium, that we can do that as well. So we're always open to whatever the students want to do. So, and that's one of the things about our department is we kind of kid we have no style because we're looking for the students to find what their style is and who they want to be. And so we're not trying to dictate anything to them. We're simply wanting to know who they want to be so we can make them that.
Well, and that's very important, too, because you say that lightly, but it's true. I mean, mm-hmm. some people, if your expertise is a certain area, there's a reason you went where you went, Jim, mm-hmm. to get your BFA in painting and drawing, because that's their specialty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in the way of the world, there's so many more options mm-hmm. out there and so many more ways to use art mm-hmm. and design, too, I think, mm-hmm. as well. And mm-hmm. I think that's probably a big part of the awakening for the mm-hmm. younger generation, too. I mean, everywhere you look, art and science are everywhere. I mean, that's what mm-hmm. we talk about every week here.
Right, right.
Most of us just walk around with our blinders.
Right.
Is to see how all the different options, mm-hmm. career options, job ways to apply
mm-hmm. right.
the art and design that there is out mm-hmm. there these
I think
days.
I think what we do in that is something that I talk about when I teach about education, and that is that people habituate. So they get used to going by the same thing mm-hmm. over and over and seeing it, mm-hmm. but they don't see it anymore.
No, mm-hmm. no.
You know, right. and so it takes actually, I think that's maybe the most important gift of the arts. It takes looking at it mm-hmm. anew.
Right.
Right,
right. Yes, exactly. And so, I mean, it's just like you walk around and if you look at trees, they're not all the same. They're different shapes. Uh-huh. The limbs grow one way on one tree and kind of drop down on another. There's just different shapes and the way they're formed, the way a evergreen looks from a tree with leaves on it. So there's all that. And so the textures and the feel are also different. And so if you're going to put that in a painting or drawing or an illustration or animation, you have to know those things. Otherwise, it looks clunky. And what we always tell our students is if you don't understand it, the viewer's not going to understand it. Mm-hmm. So you have to know it more than they do.
That's true. That's Jim Veway. He and Randy Fry are our guests this afternoon. And if you have a question for them, we would most certainly like to hear it. You can pick up the phone, give us a call at 317-788-3314. And Jim, you talked about 140 majors now, right?
130, yes.
Okay. Yeah. And you guys are, because of that growth, you are hoping to grow and expand from
yes.
one building space to another. And then that's also kind of a collaboration with yet another department as well.
Right. So we're in the process of relocating the Department of Art and Design to a new facility, or let's see, a new use facility. So we're going to be moving into a old factory building that'll be rehabbed for us, and we'll actually be partnering with engineering on that. So it's yet again of that idea of marrying science and the arts together.
Yeah. And how has that reaction been? How's that reaction from the engineering department been, knowing that you guys are kind of
– Oh, great. Yeah. Because we actually have – right now we have an engineering student who's been working on a project in our wood shop. And so, yeah, so they're really – we're all excited about the possibilities.
Tell me about that.
The project?
Yeah.
I don't know about it 100% because I keep walking by the door and seeing him in there. And so this student a couple of years ago, we have what we call a spring term. And so it's a sort of non-traditional class that we do. And so for the last few years, I was doing a woodworking class. And he took that class with me and built this kind of funky giant rocking chair. And so he really liked that aspect of getting to work in the wood shop. And so he came back this fall and said, can I get back in the wood shop? I said, of course you can get back in the wood shop, but I don't run the wood shop anymore. So I sent him to our sculptor who now runs the wood shop, and he's been working in there. So he was creating a form and then poured 2 gallons of resin into it and was sanding away in there. So what all is going on, I haven't stopped. I asked him to let me know as soon as he's done so I can see what he's up to.
That's very exciting mm-hmm. stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's really exciting because, he got the sense of, oh, not only can I design something with my engineering skills, but now I can think about the aesthetics of it as well.
So mm-hmm. for people that are listening, I always want to go back to University of Indianapolis is a liberal arts school.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the advantage of a liberal arts school is in what you just said.
Yes.
There
yes, it is.
There are silos, but they aren't siloed so far
no.
that students aren't exposed to a lot of stuff that helps them later in life. And I think that's so important.
Oh, it's very important because what you may learn in a literature class may inform mm-hmm. what you do mm-hmm. in your art. That may all of a sudden become, who you are as an artist, that you're utilizing that as the concept of your piece. And mm-hmm. so especially when you get into animation illustration where, you're storytelling, mm-hmm. so that literature class may really, affect who you are as an artist in that storytelling.
And also in this day and age, it's so unusual for one person to have the same career their entire life.
That's mm-hmm. true.
It used to not be that. We used to be when you decided what you were going to do, that's what you did, mm-hmm. and you stayed mm-hmm. maybe one place for your entire career, but that just doesn't happen mm-hmm. these days.
No, and we know the skills going forward, and that's why I would tell mm-hmm. any parent, send your child to liberal arts school
yes.
first.
Yes,
then
I
specialize,
agree.
Including
yeah.
even if you're going to be an artist.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
But especially today, I work with an engineer, it was really hard for us to find one for Da Vinci Pursuit that could actually be able to break away from things. Mm-hmm. And the guy we found, it makes sense. he retrofits electric engines into existing gas-powered vehicles.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah. And so he has to be all the time using all of his liberal arts training to figure that out.
Oh, yeah.
Because he isn't building it new.
No.
So a lot of our engineers build things new, and they never have to use any of the other parts of their liberal arts training if they have it.
Right.
And so I think it's really critical.
Oh, I think a liberal arts education you can't beat because, you know, what we're doing is we're teaching our students to be creative thinkers, problem solvers, and those are both things you're going to use no matter where you go in life.
Right.
We are talking with Jim Vway and Randy Fry, and we are going to take a short break, and we hope that you will join us in our conversation. You can do so by calling 317-788-3314, and we'll be right back with more of She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
The Score is a weekly celebration of the music that makes good movies great. Host Edmund Stone covers all the bases with such topics as playing politics, summer blockbusters, The Orchestrator, Stranded, and features on individual composers for the cinema. It's a cultural trip through everyone's most common musical experience. That's The Score with Edmund Stone, Saturday mornings at 10 on WICR, a different kind of public radio.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
We'll be back December the 1st with a brand new season of live Saturday matinee broadcasts featuring your favorite singers.
Anin Drebko,
Joyce DiDonato,
Javier Camarena,
Christine Gerkey,
Sonia Yoncheva,
Roberto Alagna,
Isabel Leonard,
Priti Yende,
Placio Domingo,
just to name a few. Tune in Saturdays from December to May on the Toll Brothers Metropolitan Opera International Radio Network.
That's this Saturday at 1 on WICR HD2, the mirror image.
And welcome back. We are talking once again about how science influences art today, especially when it comes to technology. And joining us are Jim Vway and Randy Fry, both from the University of Indianapolis.
Yeah, and I wanted to lead us back in with the idea that it's interesting in the digital world that we have so many things that came from Jim, the foundation world at the very beginning.
Right.
And so almost everything you do with teaching students digital is based on something people did physically.
That's true.
And so can you describe a couple of those things that come across? That-
sure. I mean, just going back to kind of traditional animation, when they were literally drawing frame by frame each movement and then deciding how many frames they needed to make it look believable.
Yeah.
That's all, you know, was all done by hand. You know, the discovering how to make all this work was done by hand to begin with.
Yeah.
And I want them to understand that, too, so that they don't rely on the digital aspect as a crutch, you know, to be able to understand where we're getting this terminology from is important. You know, in design, when I'm teaching, say, software like Illustrator or Photoshop, you know, Photoshop harkens back to traditional photography when you're in the dark lab and you're using, you know, dodge and burn. And there is a dodge and burn tool in Photoshop, but it's a little hard to describe given that not many students have that kind of traditional photography background in a dark room.
Right.
Yeah, I had a traditional training in how to use an airbrush as a student.
So did I.
And I love it with the tools that Wacom has on the tablet working with Photoshop. Mm-hmm. I can grab that thing and it feels like an airbrush.
Mm-hmm. It does, yeah.
But students who've never had an airbrush, they could just use a regular stylus for all that matters.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You know, the nice thing that we have now, we have digital, you know, we have pens that, you know, a Wacom tablet or Cintiqs that our students are able to use. So it's great now that they're beginning to be able to feel the pen move across the surface as they're drawing so that it feels like it did traditionally. Mm-hmm. Incorporating that into the classroom has been really exciting for the students. And what's really funny is that many of the kind of technology tools that we have, for instance, a digital brush, a digital paintbrush, there's many students that are, or many software companies that are coming out with new brushes that feel like, say, printmaking or that look like an oil brush, a mixer brush now in Photoshop that can you can grab two different colors and it'll mix both of them together and you can sample these mixed colors and get another brush stroke. And it feels very much like the traditional methods, which is fantastic.
Yeah, and that's moved over, I know, a huge deal when Apple came out with their own pen, mm-hmm. pencil for that tablet. Mm-hmm. And now it's got pressure sensitivity and it's got, you know, you can rotate it and it senses its rotation.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's just like what I used to do when we did painting,
right?
Illustration, I was always rolling the pencil. People always mm-hmm. wonder when you draw a straight line, you have to roll the pencil.
Yeah.
Right.
So that you don't get a flat edge, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
really amazing to me.
Yeah, it's really fun. And was really fantastic this year, the incoming freshmen, a lot of them already had experience with mm-hmm. those tablets or have their own that they can bring to the classroom. And I'm like, oh, this is really fantastic. Look what you can do, you know. Or I can show them new techniques that they can do with a technology they didn't maybe even know they could mm-hmm. do. You know, like you said, like the rotation of the brush, you know, changing your settings.
Jim, really do you find when they come in with that, sometimes that digital skill, that then they go, aha, when they get an actual physical using a like a brush or a pencil?
No.
Darn.
No, unfortunately not. No. Unfortunately, the technology part doesn't translate to the real hands-on thing.
Got it.
And so if we're getting more and more students over time, you ask that question, how things have changed over the 19 years, and that's one of the things that's changed over that time period is that the way education is now in the high schools and such, we have fewer and fewer students coming in with a background in art already. And so we're having to teach more of the fundamentals of how to do things.
Just even how to hold a pencil.
Yeah, I try not to mess with how to hold a pencil because if I do that, we're going to be probably further out. But, you know, it's how to make marks with that pencil.
Got it.
And how to understand how line can have character. And so it's not just – and you're talking about rolling the pencil, and sometimes, you know, you want a thin line, you want a thick line. That line can have character. When you're drawing a line, you know, having just a smooth line is not always the best thing. Sometimes that line needs to have fluctuation. And so if we can teach them these things of how line and form can have character, you know, when they get up to Randy, then that helps a little bit so that their forms can have more character in the things they're creating for their illustrations and animations.
Yeah. Because technology is changing so quickly all the time, mm-hmm. how often do you feel like you're going to have to continue to, you know, change the curriculum here, or do you want to kind of leave it set for a while to get some things in mind and in practice? Or
I think the curriculum is okay. Mm-hmm. I think it's just how we utilize the technology as it comes along, and so no matter how the technology changes, you still have to know how to draw, how mm-hmm. to see. That's not going to change. Mm-hmm. And so we don't have to change the curriculum for that. We just have to keep working with the students to help them understand that. Randy has the challenge because as the technology changes, she has to keep learning the new technology so that she can stay up to date to teach the students. So she's the one that has the greater challenge. And so it's not so much changing our curriculum as much as our faculty who have expertise in the technology have to keep up to date with that.
Well, and now you have your first student who has graduated with the digital media degree. Is that correct, you said?
Yeah. He will be graduating in May.
Yes. Yeah. So it's a Bachelor of Science with animation illustration as a area of focus. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How will he be able to help you to know if you're teaching the right things, if it's working in the right progress or the right process? I mean, I think he could be a really good tool as the program grows, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the students' kind of exploration into their own interests will be really interesting mm-hmm. to see how they're able to utilize that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think there's a lot of possibilities. It's just going to be exploring and
right.
seeing what they can do. Yeah.
And then as a faculty, as a department, there's a couple things we do. As faculty, we all look at the exhibition and provide feedback mm-hmm. to the department and so that we can understand how we all think it's working. One, and two, we ask each student to give us feedback. Okay, you're done with your time here. what did you think? What would you do to change it? What can we do to improve it? Those sorts of things. So we're always seeking feedback, whether it's from us or from the students themselves, because we want to know what they think and mm-hmm. how they felt about everything. Because we're always looking to improve ourselves, and we, you know, and our students are a good resource for that because they've been through it. They know what they liked and didn't like, and so we want to know that.
And to be able to balance out with what they need with what they need mm-hmm. for the basics, but what they're going to need for the future
yeah.
when they leave here too,
exactly.
and as things change
mm-hmm.
too.
Right.
What are some of the things that your digital media students are working on right now, Randy?
Let's see. We're working on a comic book in one of our classes where the students are actually developing their own stories. So we talked about, you know, how it's great to have this kind of liberal arts experience where I've been encouraging them, go take a creative writing class.
Yeah.
You know, go take, you know, any kind of other classes that you can get on campus, like, even an acting class, a basic kind of acting class would be great to have. So, yeah, they've been working on this comic book. We've been working on some animations, kind of student-led animations in the beginning animation class, where they're developing their own characters, their own worlds. You know, some of them were very interested in just simple animals, you know, stories based on kind of nature. Others were creating Martians and, you know, beings from other galaxies, which was really great. They're such a diverse group of students, and
yeah.
they all have these really fantastic imaginations,
mm-hmm.
which
yeah.
is really exciting for me as a professor. It just keeps you on your toes, and the conversations we have in class just can, you know, you can imagine talking about how this Martian's leg, it's not quite going in the direction I think it should. You know, you just have the most fantastic conversations with students, and critiques can be really interesting, which is really great. But yeah.
We have sometimes that happens within the work that we do with the Venture Pursuit, mm-hmm. where we'll have some scientists look at some of the artists' work and ask some really, well, mm-hmm. well, how could that even happen?
Right,
you
right,
know, I
right.
mean,
yes.
Yeah.
yes.
From a science viewpoint.
Yeah.
Or an artist is trying to work something out, and they'll
mm-hmm.
actually look to the scientists and say, well,
oh, yeah.
how does gravity work? I
yeah.
don't
right.
understand.
Yeah.
You know,
because
yeah.
they want to make it more like it would really
yeah.
work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I think, yeah, it's really interesting, students exchanging and
yeah.
looking at that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
yeah.
So much of the time we have to ask the student, you know, what is their idea, why are they doing what they're doing? Because if they're trying to do something that denies gravity, denies how things rationally work, okay, but why are you trying to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not, then we need to make sure that it works rationally and, mm-hmm. and it does understand the idea of gravity and how the, you know, the anatomy of a form mm-hmm. actually could function.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and it goes back to, you know, a lot of people think that you just do these things because there's digital assets or you can just take them and
right.
copy
right,
and
right,
paste.
Right.
But even in using those, it's still what makes composition, what
right.
makes
mm-hmm.
form.
Right.
And a lot of people are confused, like people that were like Picasso, you
mm-hmm.
know. But he had foundational work first.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
To be
oh,
able
yeah.
to depart from that.
Right.
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 I mean, many of his paintings, so. He had so many studies before
oh,
he
yeah.
got to the final piece.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
yeah.
So. And sometimes that's just the most beautiful part of it, actually.
It is. I have actually a quote on my studio wall over here at UIndy. That basically says the piece you're looking used to looking at in the museum didn't just appear there, but
mm-hmm.
it came from a smelly studio that the artist spent hours, you know, maybe hundreds mm-hmm. of hours working on.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's all that blood, sweat, and tears behind it that creates this beautiful piece you see on the museum wall.
And you guys can come to the Krannert Library here at U of Indy to see Randy's work and to see Jim's work and to the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Gallery as well. Thank you both, Jim and Randy, for being here. We really appreciate
oh,
your
great.
Time
thank
today.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
And once again, visit our website, thedaVinciPursuit.com. Till next time, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to
stay curious.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m.